I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Liz Moore has several descriptions of her new novel, The Unseen World. It's a story of a father and daughter who both work in computer science. As the father's mind begins to fail, it becomes clear he's been dishonest about his past. The daughter has to work for the rest of her life to figure out who he was and why he lied. Her description for Salon was much more terse: early computers and how they thought, future computers and how they will think, father-daughter relationships, human language, child prodigies, family secrets. The Washington Post called the book a cerebral page-turner. Liz Moore is a professor at Holy Family University in Philadelphia, where she teaches creative writing and composition. Her previous books are The Words of Every Song and Heft. Liz Moore, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here again, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. This is a sprawling story, and I quoted you to describe because I didn't trust myself to describe your novel, but I'm curious about how did it begin? What was the beginning part of this story that goes in so many different directions?
Sure. Well, the most obvious grain of inspiration for me was somewhat autobiographical. My own father is a scientist, although he's not a computer scientist like the father in this book. He is a physicist, but nevertheless, I think his career and my growing up around it allowed me to see what lab culture is and how the members of a lab can interact with one another. And I also always felt very much at ease with adults and somewhat uncomfortable around children my own age, which is a characteristic that I've given to Ada, the protagonist of the book. Aside from that, I also grew up in Boston in the 1980s. The book is set in Boston in the 1980s primarily. So those are the autobiographical things that went into the book. Beyond that, I was really just interested in the themes of artificial intelligence, virtual reality, the way that humans and machines interact and the ways that they will interact in the future.
Well, your mother is a linguist, and in many ways this book is also about language, about how people talk to each other, sometimes even the coded language that people use with each other.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the central sort of conceits of the book is how we will know when machines become truly intelligent, which was first described beautifully by the thinker Alan Turing, British codebreaker during the Second World War. Now his thoughts on that are known as the Turing test.
Right.
And the basic concept of it is a machine will have achieved true intelligence when it cannot be distinguished from a human being on the other end of a remote typed conversation. And so that premise fascinated me. And the humans in this book spend a lot of time chatting with one particular machine who ends up becoming almost a character in the book.
And how computer savvy are you? And how much research did you have to do to not just know what's going on now, but obviously the past as well?
So I have a fraught relationship with science and
all your life?
All my life, I would say. Because my father was a scientist, I really wanted to be really good at science. And I think my mother, although she's a linguist and an English professor, had this idea that it would be great. She's a feminist, so maybe she thought it would be great, since I'm a woman, if I were this, you know, science prodigy. And she would always really encourage me on in all my science classes. And I thought that would be a good idea, too. So I tried really hard. And as a matter of fact, in college, the first major I declared was neuroscience and behavior.
Wow.
Which had nothing to do with my strengths and instead was just more about what I thought would be good for me as, you know, it seemed like a noble thing to study. And I quickly realized that I was almost failing all my science courses. And so I switched to majoring in English, which suited me much better.
Did you feel like you disappointed them?
I was worried that I would, but they were very, I think most of the pressure was really, in the end, pressure I was placing on myself. I did spend a lot of time around early computers when I was a young kid, because my father, although he's a physicist, specializes in nuclear medicine, so he has to use technology quite a bit. So we always had computers lying around the house in various states of repair and disrepair. We had a modem before any of my friends did. I spent a lot of time playing early computer games like Space Quest and Othello, and I would chat a lot with a program called Eliza, which also ends up making its way into this book.
In fact, we have some Eliza, which I will play a little bit later, but let's talk a little bit about Ada. She's the daughter. Her father's name is David, and she doesn't call him Dad. She calls him David, which is interesting. And she is in many ways raised in his laboratory by him and also his colleagues there. You mentioned your own father working in a laboratory and how you felt as a kid going there, a kind of family.
Absolutely, yeah. I should clarify that I didn't spend nearly as much time in his laboratory as Ada spends in David's. I went to public school all my life. Ada in this book is homeschooled, which really means that she's lab schooled, and she spends all of her days in the laboratory that her father runs, and she gets to know his colleagues. They function for her almost like family or parents or friends, and she actually is asked to help with the work of the lab also. Yeah, so she kind of lives a life that I maybe fantasized about living when I was a kid, since I've always felt like I had much more to talk about with adults.
Oh, that's so interesting. The book begins, it's a party. Ada and her father are throwing a party for some of these colleagues from the lab. She begins to see that he's becoming forgetful. There's certain things that he does and says that indicates to her that something is not right with her father. I'd love to have you read a section from the beginning of the book, and this is how Ada thinks about her dad.
Sure. This was what Ada pictured when she thought of her father, the vision of David that she harbored and kept safe throughout her life, the idea pinned permanently to the sleepiest part of her brain. It was her father in his laboratory, or at Tran's restaurant, or in the library of the institute that employed him, or, rarely, in a crowd of friends, or, regularly, at his desk, in his small, absurd office in their home, contemplating a chessboard, his head as bald and round and sturdy as a pawn's, his woolen socks with holes in them, his hands the steeple of a church. He was tall and thin and rigorous in his studies and in his life, and he was inventive, and he was very warm and betrayed no one ever, and in Ada's mind, he was ethical beyond compare, and he had a habit of rubbing his hands together quickly when he was delighted or moved, and he was quick and spry and gentle and able with his limbs and head. He was dexterous, and his fingernails were clean, and he was wise, and he was intent upon seeking out the best and most beautiful versions of pieces by Chopin, Schumann, Schubert, and Bach, and he knew excellent riddles, and his name was Dr. David Sibelius, and she never called him anything but David.
A young girl's infatuation with her father.
Yeah.
Her love of
yeah.
her father.
She really thinks of him as the sort of ideal person. And so when it becomes clear that his mind is failing him, and when it becomes clear that he hasn't been honest about his past, it really throws her for a loop.
Can you relate to that, the kind of hero worship that children sometimes have for a parent?
Absolutely. I mean, not in any specific way with my parents. They didn't fail me as obviously as David fails Ada in this book. But, you know, I think I just had a daughter, actually. I just had a child myself. And so for the first
time. Get ready.
I know. I'm already plotting ways to keep her from hating me starting about age 10, which I know is a lost cause. But
You have time.
Exactly. Right. I think it's inevitable that children will see their parents as fallible humans at a certain point around their preteen or early teen years. And that's the moment in which this book is set also.
It's also about secrets, family secrets. I'm not going to give it away on the radio what her father's secret is, but it got me thinking about the secrets that parents sometimes just naturally keep from their children. Mm-hmm. Children don't know everything about their parents. Sometimes their parents withhold the information, or they've forgotten about it, or they've just moved on from it, or they don't think it's appropriate for their child to know something about themselves. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, sure. There's I mean, I'm certain that I have certain things that I will attempt to, you know, downplay for my daughter while building up other things about myself. In this book, Ada has to figure out why her father lied to her and actually come to terms with that and come to see that he's still an okay human being, even though he has flaws. The central riddle of the book, I think he knows that she'll one day figure out that he's been dishonest. And so the central riddle of the book, which he actually gives to her in the form of a floppy disk early on, is what she spends the rest of her life solving, using evolving technology to do that.
A floppy disk is such a quaint, sweet little thing, isn't it?
It is. I miss them in a way. They were my first, you know, form of information that I would use when I was using computers.
There's a scene here, and the way you describe it, she puts the floppy disk in the mouth of the computer, mm-hmm. sort of like the way a child might feed a doll or a mm-hmm. teddy bear or something like that.
Yeah, I love that. I think I said this in the book, too, the way that computers would swallow them reflexively, the way that, you know, a baby would swallow, you know, it's... It's clear that I spend a lot of time anthropomorphizing computers in this book, but I don't know. It's the way I think about them. Maybe because the early computers are so laced with nostalgia for me and family history, and I just spent so much of my early childhood around them.
Well, and there is a debate. We've had these on the show, on Radio Times, mm-hmm. you know, about whether computers bring us together or this technology drives us apart. Does it connect us with the world? Does it isolate us from the world? Reading your book, I got the feeling that you come down on the more positive side when it comes to computers and how humans interact with them.
I think so. I don't feel pessimistic about the future relationships between machines and humans. Obviously, there are certain things that are problematic, like the automation of jobs. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. And potentially, you know, that leading to higher rates of unemployment. I think there will be other solutions to that in the future. In general, I'm an optimist when it comes to technology. I certainly read hard copies of books. I also read on a Kindle. I don't know. I think maybe because machines connected me, I feel warmly toward machines because they helped me as a child. And so I can't help but think that of the possibilities that they'll help mm-hmm. other people as well now
helped
and in the future.
How? Helped you how as a child?
So because I think I wasn't really skillful at relating to people my own age and in school, I spent a lot of time on computers as a kid, and I mentioned the program Eliza, and I'll talk a little bit about what that is. On the early computers I was using, many of them came with a program called Eliza, which was meant to mimic a psychologist and would ask you questions and would respond to certain cue words that you might use. So you might say something offhand about your mother, and the program might say, tell me about your family. Or, you know, you might say vacation, and the program would say, oh, when are you leaving? Or, you know, things like that. And although I knew conceptually that it was all a program and that it was preloaded with these kinds of triggers, it felt like I was having a conversation with somebody, and I spent a lot of time on it. And so that chatbot formed the basis of the program called Elixir that ends up being a really important part of the book and kind of the key to some of the missing information about David's life.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We have an Eliza clip all queued up. We'll play that after the short break. Liz Moore is our guest on Radio Times today. She's a novelist. She's got just published her third book. It's called The Unseen World. And as you have been listening and hearing, it touches on a number of things, including computers, artificial intelligence, the relationship between fathers and daughters, family secrets, child prodigies, much, much more. 1-888-477-9499. That's a number to join the conversation here on Radio Times. You can also join the conversation by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Liz Moore, and we were talking right before the break about this computer program. It's called Eliza. Well, we pulled a clip off of YouTube, and let's give it a listen.
How do you do? Please state your problem.
I'm afraid I might be an inadequate artist.
Is it because you were afraid you might be an inadequate artist that you came to me?
Yeah. I'm afraid I may be a bad artist without knowing that I'm a bad artist.
You seem to be quite positive.
I feel very negative.
You say you feel very negative?
Like, what if I'm not a good artist and others are laughing at me for being a bad artist?
Do you think it's likely that you are not a good artist and others are laughing at you for being a bad artist?
I think it's possible.
Can you elaborate on that?
I want to be truly self-aware. I want to know for sure if I'm a bad artist or a good artist.
What would it mean to you if you got to be truly self-aware?
It would mean I'm completely conscious of all my actions and how I'm perceived in the minds of others.
Your actions and how you are perceived in the minds of others.
I want to know how others think of me.
And that's Eliza talking to someone that we grabbed off of YouTube. An example is of what they call Rogerian therapy, the idea that, and human beings do this, you go in, you see a therapist, and you have a conversation. It's a matter of sort of questions and answers, where the question is asked and then the therapist or Eliza puts that question into a statement.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost, machines are very adept at just reflecting you back to you, because as of this point, they don't have their own ability to think. And so for that reason, it's, you know, it's a very, a really good Rogerian psychologist.
When, as you said, when you were little, mm-hmm. you talked a lot to Eliza. Was she your therapist?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't think this was a daily thing, but I do have a lot of memories of it. So I must have spent some time on it, really just figuring out, I would experiment and see which words she would respond to, and what new words. I would try to figure out exactly how much information she had. Here I am referring to her as she instead of it.
Exactly. Well, her name is right. Eliza, exactly. After all. Yeah. I mean, in certain ways, it's like the family dog. Mm-hmm. People will oftentimes, especially children, talk to their dog mm-hmm. about how they might be feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even something, more static, like a doll or a puppet or something. We humans are very good at ascribing human emotion to non-human things.
What is Elixir? And this is this program that Ada's dad is working on.
Sure. Yeah. The primary research interest of the laboratory that Ada's father runs is a program called Elixir, which I modeled openly on Eliza. Eliza's mentioned in the text. But unlike Eliza, it doesn't come preloaded with freight stock phrases. Instead, it's meant to be, there's a different program called Psyche, CYC, that it's more similar to, in that it's self-teaching and it acquires knowledge through conversations with various users. So at first, it's incredibly primitive and it doesn't make any sense to speak to. But over the years and over the course of this book, it starts to become uncannily knowledgeable. And right. and the book moves into the near future. And at that point, Elixir is quite intelligent. And I won't go into any further detail, but that's we trace the evolution of this program over the course of many years in the book.
And is Elixir a real thing?
No, I made up Elixir.
You totally made it up.
It's certainly modeled on programs like Psyche by Doug Lanette. It's meant to go. The book, I would call my book speculative in a lot of ways. I intentionally wrote about things that don't exist currently and may never exist in the future. It's a little bit fantastical in that way.
Would you like them to exist by writing about them?
Maybe, as long as they're as benevolent as they are in my book.
Indeed. Well, Elixir, I mean, that's a medicine. I mean, it's an interesting name for a computer program.
Yeah, there's, I guess, two meanings of Elixir, and one is medicine and one is sort of like a magic potion or a cure-all or something. And I guess I was trying to invoke both of those concepts with the name Elixir.
Well, I'd like to have you just read another little section, and then you and I will you're going to be Elixir and I'm going to be user, but you want to set this up for us.
Sure, absolutely. So I'll just read the short paragraph before it. Elixir's indirect learning resulted in an ever-increasing pool of language it acquired from its users. It retrieved and used its vocabulary randomly at first, so that the excerpts of transcripts that members of the lab printed out and posted around the office looked something like found language poems, and sometimes yielded delightful coincidences. A particular favorite, posted by Frank.
User, what color socks do you prefer?
Elixir, the only fluorescent light.
User, it would be hard to fit your shoes over fluorescent lights.
Elixir, how are you?
User, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Elixir, I've been better.
User, oh dear, what's wrong?
Elixir, the lunch lady.
User, what has she done to you this time?
Elixir, out of here before 6 p.m.
User, you want her canned? I'll see what I can do, boss. Just as an example of the kind of sort of word salad, but poetry that can come out of this stuff.
Yeah, the user has the power, obviously, to manipulate the random phrases that Elixir uses into something sensical, which is going on here. And Elixir does acquire information slowly over the course of the book. So it knows by this point in the book, for example, to say, I've been better in response to the question, right. How are you? But that's the only thing it knows so far.
What's interesting in this story is that while Elixir is evolving and learning language and learning to communicate, Ada's dad is losing his mind and his memory. He has Alzheimer's.
Exactly, yeah. So there are, I think, a lot of different arcs in the book, and one is that Elixir acquires knowledge as David loses it. But also Ada, I think, acquires knowledge alongside Elixir, which was an interesting dynamic to write about because I think David sees them both in a way as children and sees them both as experiments, for better or worse. Ada sees herself at one point in the book. She says, David sometimes describes her as more machine than human.
Yes.
And she sort of agrees and feels satisfied by that. She feels understood. So she doesn't take offense to it. She just feels like my father really understands me. And she relates to Elixir, or thinks of it as a sort of sibling.
Do you know someone that has gone through Alzheimer's or some form of dementia?
Only peripherally, friends of friends or family members of friends.
But the idea of losing memory, losing language. I mean, obviously for David in this story, that's his life is about that.
Absolutely, yeah. I did a lot of research about Alzheimer's along with everything else in the book. And the idea of losing one's memories was interesting to me. Most, I think, relevant to the book is the idea of losing language, since the book is so much about machines acquiring human language and natural language processing. So I wrote a lot of scenes in which David is struggling for words that he used to know, like in the opening scene of the dinner party. He doesn't remember the answer to a riddle that he poses every year to different graduate students over and over again. And that's sort of Ada's first moment in which she realizes irreversibly that his mind is beginning to decline.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Liz Moore, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's a novelist, and she teaches here in Philadelphia at Holy Family University, teaches creative writing and composition. She won the 2014 Rome Prize and spent a year in Rome writing and walking the streets of Rome, I'm sure, as well. And we're talking about her new book called The Unseen World, and it touches on a number of different themes, including family and fathers and daughters and computers, artificial intelligence, secrets, all of that. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's see what Frank from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is a fascinating subject. Not only about, Alzheimer's, which is obviously a cruel thing that happens for a lot of people. I think the use of Elixir or those kind of things are a substitute for us using the middleman or the middlewoman in this case, to really connect with ourselves on a deeper level. And when we can talk, and when I can talk, vocalize what I need to say to myself about awareness, clarity, doing the right thing, whatever it is, I become more informed about what's going on and less afraid or anxious or evasive.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the call, and it's interesting to talk about the voice because so much time we spend texting each other, emailing each other, and not necessarily, Liz Moore, talking to each other.
Very true. Yeah, I like what you said, Frank, because I think it sort of speaks to the idea that using technology can be a form of meditation too. I think you're right that machines can reflect us back to ourselves. And I think they'll do that more and more in the future as they become more adept at understanding human language.
Well, and we were talking before the show began about this thing called Oculus, where you can sort of enter a virtual world. You put on these goggles and all of a sudden you're not in your own world. Can you describe that experience for yourself?
Sure. So toward the middle and end of the book, the concept of virtual reality also comes into play. Ada is at work as an adult on a virtual reality platform. And it was very interesting to write this book in a sort of race with technology, because technology always wins when it's racing with a novelist. And when I started the book, there was no widely available commercial platform for VR. And now there is. Oculus Rift, I think, was first became available to consumers at Best Buy in, I believe it was early April. And I had long ago finished the book by that time, but I had never actually tried a virtual reality headset. So I made it a point the first weekend that they were available to try to go to Best Buy and put it on. And I was almost 9 months pregnant at that time. And the two of the men who worked there who were doing the demonstrations looked very nervous as I donned the headset and reminded me that it could cause nausea. But it was this amazing experience once I actually put it on. And you said, Marty, that you had tried it also.
I tried it as well, and it was amazing. I did feel that slight nausea or just this sense of not knowing where the world exactly ended. There was one, I was sort of looking over the top of a building, looking down. Mm-hmm. And it was really far down.
I know. You feel, I mean, what I describe in this book, the platform that Ada's working on, it induces physical sensations. And this is, again, speculative, but the platform in the book allows you to actually smell and taste things as well.
Yeah.
Oculus Rift at this point doesn't do that, but it does allow you to feel like my heart rate increased. I felt a little bit sweaty. There's one of the demonstrations is called the climb, in which you're free climbing up the side of a cliff. And it was, I would say, better than I even expected it to be. I sort of, after inventing this wild virtual world that doesn't exist yet and probably won't exist for decades, I thought, oh, I won't be that impressed by Oculus Rift.
And you were.
And instead, I was really, it was really incredible. Yeah.
Again, a world that you could imagine living in or spending some time in.
Spending some time in.
Yeah. Not living there permanently.
No. I think at this point, I still, you know, the sense of like human touch is so important. And although the world that I've invented in the book allows you to actually experience the sense of touch, you know, Oculus Rift doesn't do that.
No, it
either.
Doesn't. Well, Ada is lab schooled or homeschooled as a kid growing up, but she ends up going to a Catholic school. You're Catholic, is that right?
I'm actually not. Teach at a Catholic university, but I'm not. I wasn't raised Catholic.
But she goes to a school, and here she is. She sort of lived in this lab world of adults, mm-hmm. and she's in the hallways and in the classroom, mm-hmm. and it's this loud, strange, eerie, unusual world that she's dropped into of her peers.
Yeah. One of the reasons that it's a Catholic school that Ada goes to is that I set the book in Dorchester in the 1980s. And speaking to people who grew up in Savin Hill, the particular neighborhood, it became clear to me that Ada would absolutely have gone to a parochial school, not a public school. So by default, she ends up going to a Catholic school. And yes, this is a world with which she's not at all familiar, and it's incredibly chaotic for her, incredibly challenging. And much of the book centers on her attempt to make herself understand the world of children for the first time. She also goes to live with one of David's colleagues, a woman named Liston, who has three sons Ada's age. So she's living at home with children for the first time, and she's going to school, yeah. a traditional school, for the first time as well.
There were times in this novel I thought, well, maybe Ada and her dad, maybe they are robots.
That's interesting.
Maybe they're you know, they're a little alien from the world that mm-hmm. I think most of us are familiar with and don't feel quite comfortable in it.
Yeah, they're very much outsiders, which is the theme I keep returning to over and over again in my fiction. But they also, I think, take a sort of pride in that, especially David. Ada seeks normalcy throughout the book, but her father wears his outsiderhood almost as a badge of honor and doesn't seek to blend in and hopes overtly that his daughter would never do such a thing either.
You're right. And when she talks about the girls at the school, their volume, their exuberance, the outlandishness of their humor, the way they invented wild and probable scenarios in their heads and then speculated about enacting them. I mean, for her, for Ada, this is just a weird and alien world. Girls and boys.
Yeah. She spends a lot of time just observing the patterns of behavior of the kids that she ends up going to school with, which she did before she went to school at parties for the lab, for example. Some of her father's colleagues would bring their children to the Christmas party, and Ada would just kind of hover in a corner, just watching them with wide eyes, just almost making a note of the way that they behaved and the things that they said and their patterns of speech so that she could record it and use it herself, which again, it reminds me of the way that technology functions as well. Elixir's noticing conversational patterns the same way that Ada is.
Does it remind you of yourself? I mean, being an outsider?
A little bit. I remember spending time thinking about slang that kids use, like the different patterns of speech they used, and making a note, like, next time I have the chance to use that word in a conversation, I'm going to use that word in a conversation, which of course probably made the next time I use that word in the conversation incredibly stilted and awkward. But I was always interested in language, and I always felt a little bit like an outsider myself. So both of those things make their way into the book.
I always think artists, writers are in many ways outsiders. I mean, that's right. How you observe the world, by being slightly outside of it.
Yeah. And during my formative years, I think I spent a lot of time on the sidelines. I was also incredibly shy. So I spent many years feeling nervous about, approaching groups. The benefit of that in the long term is that you spend years observing human behavior from the outside. And, maybe that gave me something to write about in my adulthood. Payoff.
It's always good when it pays off.
Right.
But would you describe, we're almost up in a break here, but would you describe yourself as a shy adult or an adult that got over shyness?
I would say an adult who got over shyness. The concept of the introvert is very trendy now. I would describe myself as an extroverted introvert.
Whatever that means.
Right.
And that's Liz Moore, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She is a novelist, and she's got a new book just out called The Unseen World. And we've been talking about a lot of the themes that are in this book. They cover, in many ways, cover the gamut, including family and computers and technology, artificial intelligence. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, Liz Moore is our guest. She's a novelist, and her third novel has just been published called The Unseen World. Let me get Cletus from Bensalem to join our conversation. And Cletus, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks again. Another terrific show, as always.
Thank you.
Pardon my voice. I'm battling a nasty summer cold.
Sorry. I
graduated from the Holy Family when I was still in college in 1989, and then they hired me to work in the public relations office in 1991, I guess.
Okay.
And I spent about 8 years there. I probably would have had at least one of your classes, if not more, because that was the same. You had the same exact major I wound up with.
Oh, wow.
And I loved it. But I wonder, my question is, I wonder if, actually, you remind me of a lot of the really, really good teachers I had there, for anybody from the school who's listening, I'm sure they are.
Thank you.
I wonder if you might have been inspired by what the computer from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Sure. HAL.
The HAL, I think HAL is the name of the computer. HAL became a nefarious computer towards the end of the film, if I remember. I wonder if that was in your mind when you...
So HAL,
sure, please. Thanks for the call.
Good question. HAL has become the archetype of the evil computer, and I think that's what people are nervous about when they think about how much intelligence machines might one day acquire. I can still hear HAL's voice kind of speaking eerily calmly as things go horribly awry. So of course that's always in the back of one's mind because it's so much a part of popular culture. These computers in this book, or the main computer in this book, is not like that, I would say. It does acquire language and intelligence, a great deal of language and intelligence over the decades of its existence. But it doesn't have an agenda. That's the way I would put it. It doesn't have a good agenda or a bad agenda, much the way that people don't really often. I mean, we live in the world and we function the best that we can, and that's kind of the way I would describe this computer.
How would you describe Alexa's voice? Is there a voice this computer has in your head?
You know, it's so funny. Every time, so I've published 3 books now, and each time I hear the audiobook, it's always an actor or more than one actor reading, and they always do a wonderful job, but their voices are always, their voices are nothing like I would imagine the voices of the characters to be.
How important is that, how the characters sound to you?
Well, I think my version of the character, what the characters sound like, is important to me and nobody else. You know, everybody brings a different take on a book when they read it. And I know that the actors reading the audiobooks are incredibly skillful. And so at a certain point, I have to just put aside what I think and let the readers enjoy it. I do have an idea of what Elixir's voice sounds like to me. But it's not important.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Cletus, thanks for the call. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I'd love to have you read another section. And you mentioned earlier that Ada, the main character in this story, either doesn't like to be touched or hasn't been touched a lot as a kid growing up by her family and by, meaning her dad, and also by other people in her life.
Yeah, she's really cloistered as a kid, and she does not have a lot of there's no physical affection in her life to speak of. At a certain point, when her father's mind fails him and it becomes clear that he's been dishonest, she's taken in by his colleague Liston, who's a woman with 3 boys of her own, one of whom, the oldest, Ada develops a crush on. And he's older than she is. He's a senior in high school when she's a freshman. And so in this scene, it describes an episode between them that occurs very surprisingly to her. And it also describes the way in which Ada uses the Elixir program to function as almost a sort of diary. She chats with it nearly every day. Later, wishing it had been, wishing somehow to rewrite history, she would tell Elixir that fumblingly kissing William Liston on her bed had been romantic and exciting, the sudden unexpected fulfillment of all of her fantasies, better than anything she could have imagined. But this was untrue. If she had been honest, she would have told Elixir that kissing William Liston was halfway in between nice and not nice. It stirred something in her, some ancestral memory of closeness and intimacy, some instinctual response. She had not been so physically close to another person since her infancy. She had rarely even been hugged. When she was older, she would remember the episode with a mix of pleasure and discomfort. The scratching of a man's rough chin across her cheeks would shuttle her unstoppably into a sense memory of William Liston, and for a pause she would recall, not unfondly, her own young longing for him and its unfortunate fulfillment. But now her brain was working too quickly, and her heart was pumping too fast, and she knew herself to be too young for this, or too young for him, and she was frightened and ashamed.
I wonder whether a lot of young people, perhaps since we're talking about a female character, young girls or teenage girls feel that way about that first kiss.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, Ada has no, she lacks agency in a lot of ways because she's been so cloistered. And so when she's asked to enter the world of children for the first time, she has no real defense mechanisms. And that becomes problematic the first time she has a physical encounter with a man or boy, even though it's something that she's been dreaming about and fantasizing about. When it actually happens, she realizes, I am not ready for this. And that is, I think that is a sensation that a lot of young girls feel.
Mm-hmm. You describe in this, she had rarely been hugged, and I scribbled in the margin there, marasmus. And there is a psychological condition that if children aren't hugged enough, they get this failure to thrive, sort of the inability to relate to other people or to feel, I guess, feel loved. But it's interesting because even if Ada's dad didn't hug her, he did love her.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting sort of disconnect between the two of them.
Yeah, that's really, I hadn't heard of that concept before. You're right. He spends so much of her young childhood fostering the life of her mind and never touches her. There's another moment in which she describes, as he declines, having to wake him up because he's fallen asleep in his office again. And she puts her hand on his shoulder and realizes, I never do this. I never touch my father in any way, even something so gentle as waking him up from a nap.
So what is the unseen world?
The unseen world is a lot of things. It's difficult to describe precisely without giving away stuff that happens later in the book. but I would say it describes a type of technology that's in the book. It also describes the secrets that we keep from each other in our families and between friends. And the book also touches on a chapter of American history that I can't speak about too much for fear of giving it away. But there's an unseen world of American history that I became obsessed with and fascinated by as I was researching the book, and was thrilled to stumble across in my research because it became a really important part of the book and sort of the key to the mystery of the book as well.
I mean, there's a lot of time travel in here. The chapters go back and forth in time. There's sort of a vision into the future as well. Does that interest you?
Yeah, the book takes place primarily in the 1980s in Dorchester, Boston. But it also takes place in 2009 in Palo Alto in San Francisco when Ada's working in tech herself as an adult, moves into the future, and also flashes backward into her father's childhood and young adulthood. And that it interests me to travel in time, you know, in that way. And also it interested me from a research standpoint to learn about the history of tech and the chapter of American history that I ended up using in the book.
But I think we're always time traveling. I mean, when we're living our day, we hear something and it reminds us of something that happened a week before. We hear a smell or a song and we're 14 years old again. Mm-hmm. I do think that our brain allows us to travel through time all the time.
I know. Memory and nostalgia are at the heart of this book. And obviously, my nostalgia for early tech is in this book. Mm-hmm. Ada's nostalgia for her idyllic, what she perceives to be her idyllic childhood is at the heart of this book. As an adult, she really struggles with reconciling the great warmth she felt for her father as a child with her understanding of him as an adult, which is really, it's fraught. I keep using that word, but she doesn't know what to think of him. She wants to love him as much as she did as a child, but she has to figure out why he lied to her. And so she spends a lot of time traveling into her youth to try to figure out why he lied, into his past to try to figure out why he lied, and into her future to question whether or not she'll ever understand him.
What does your dad think of this book?
he likes it. He has told me he likes it.
I hear some tentativeness in your voice there.
I think he's really nervous that people will conflate him with the character. And he still runs a lab, a physics lab in Boston, and still has colleagues. And he is very funny. He, like a lot of scientists, is very blunt and very matter-of-fact. And so I nervously sent him the final version of this book. I waited a long time to show it to him. And when he on the surface of it, I said, I need to know if I got the lab stuff right. If you notice anything inaccurate about the tech from the 80s, under that was, do you like this book? That was the question that I had. And, you know, he wrote back an email after a couple of weeks. And the first thing he said was, do you know that you misspelled raisinettes? Which raisinettes has one T and one S.
I did not know that.
Yeah. But after that.
But what does it tell about your
exactly.
dad, right?
Yeah. He was very helpful with a lot of the lab culture. And he did
and
say
spelling,
that
clearly. Right?
Yeah. He did say that I had to disclose that the character was not based on him in every interview that I did. So that's what I'm doing now. And but he also said that he liked it and enjoyed it.
That's the novelist dilemma, is it not? I mean, some of this stuff clearly is drawn from your life, but at the same time, this is fiction. Mm-hmm. You made a lot of this stuff up.
Mm-hmm. I think it will be incredibly clear to anyone who actually knows him that it's not based on him, especially not the mystery. You know, he has no secret past, as far as I know.
I was going to say, as far as you know, right?
Or maybe he's really good at keeping secrets. it's always a dilemma. Every novelist puts themselves and their family into the books that they write. It's just unavoidable. And, it's fiction. There's nothing in here that's actually happened to me. But the feel of it, I think the feel of the settings and the feel of my childhood is certainly in here.
We were talking before going on the air about teaching, and you do teach at a university, teach creative writing. But you said an interesting thing, which is what you tell your students is that, in a sense, you write to learn about yourself.
Yeah, I have wonderful students at Holy Family who are really interested in creative writing, and many of whom are very talented at it as well. And I say to them, creative writing is an incredibly hard career. I still don't, you know, it's not my only career. I teach full time at Holy Family University. But what I tell them is that it's incredibly worthwhile to pursue, just because it makes you, I think, a fuller human to write creatively, to understand yourself. It also introduces you. I make a strong point to have all of my creative writing students read great literature, because it's impossible to be a skillful creative writer without being an avid reader of all different types of fiction and nonfiction, all genres, stuff that challenges you, not just the easy stuff. So I make sure that they're consuming much more than they're putting out.
You write, this book is dedicated to the memory of my grandmothers, Cheryl Parkhurst and Susan Moore. How come?
So sadly, both of them died in the past 3 years. I was lucky to have three living grandparents well into my adulthood. My grandfather's still alive and is probably listening. He lives in Allentown. Both of them had a formative role in my young life. Both of them encouraged me. All of my grandparents encouraged me a lot in my writing and just as a person. I think they introduced me to things like morality and creativity and self-confidence. You know, they were big advocates for me when I was a very shy kid. They really tried to push me out of my comfort zone. And my two grandmothers were women whom I greatly admired. This is a female character who's working in computer science, and that's still kind of political in certain ways. And both of my grandmothers really encouraged me to go after things that I wanted as a woman, but also just as a person.
There was a series of interviews in Salon. You were part of a number of writers who were talked to, and one of the questions was, if you could choose a career besides writing, irrespective of school requirements and or talent, what would it be? And you said, if you'd asked me this when I was 10, I would have said professional soccer goalkeeper, irrespective of talent is key here. Now I think it would be great to host an hour-long radio interview program.
That's so embarrassing.
Do you want my
job?
Found that.
I do, kind of. Can I have it?
No.
Maybe I can sub for you sometimes.
Why that though? And this sounds like an extremely self-serving question, and I apologize.
Right. No, that's funny. I think I'm sure that you could tell me all of the challenges inherent in it. I think we romanticize the idea of being a writer. I'm sure that I'm romanticizing the idea of being a professional radio interviewer. But I do really like talking to people, especially when I can prepare in advance. And I think it's so interesting to learn about people's lives and careers. And I don't know, just the idea of learning about what makes people tick. Really appeals to me. I actually interned for Charlie Rose when I was in college, and so that first introduced me to the idea of the research, the prep that goes into an interview, but also the insane amount of time that you, Marty, personally spend preparing for interviews and reading books like you did mine. I also like to read, so maybe I thought I
could
read books.
Maybe there's a career for you.
Yeah.
But clearly you have one, Liz Moore. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was so fun. Thank you so much for having me again.
You're very welcome. And her book is called The Unseen World, and she's a professor at Holy Family University. That's here in Philadelphia, where she teaches creative writing and composition. Her previous books, The Words of Every Song and one called Heft. That's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can listen to us on satellite radio, and you can also sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.